It is a fact, says Herodotus, the Greek historian, an odd fact, yet often noted, that the farther you go from home, the stranger things get. This is Hearing Voices from NPR. I'm Larry Massett. Our show is Strange Days. Herodotus was wrong, wasn't he? Strangeness isn't a fact, it's a feeling. What may feel strange when you travel becomes normal the minute you get used to it. And for the people who live in those far-off places, nothing is strange at all, except maybe you. So why make a big deal out of it? People do, though. Strangely enough, some people spend their lives trying to make every day a strange day. How? Well, everyone takes a different tack. Let's begin with a weird bit of music, the favorite song of the writer Paul Bowles when he was a child. It's called Down Among the Sheltering Palms.
Down among the sheltering palms, oh honey, wait for me, honey, wait for me. Don't be forgetting we've got a date out where the sun goes down about 8. How my love is burning, burning, burning. How my heart keeps yearning, yearning, yearning to be down among the sheltering palms. Oh, honey, wait for me.
Well, of course, it's not meant to be weird. What's weird is the reason Bowles loved it. Here's what he says in his autobiography, read by Paul Kerman.
It was not the banal melody which fascinated me, but the strange word sheltering. What did the palm trees shelter people from, and how sure could they be of such protection? Oh, honey, wait for me, out where the sun goes down about 8.
Bowles was an odd child, born in 1910, middle-class family, father a dentist, all normal on the surface, but Bowles had these, what to call them, spells, episodes, eruptions of strangeness. Here's one he describes happening when he was about 14.
One evening, just after sunset, I decided to go down the hill where the nearest shops were and have something cold at Roth's soda fountain. The shop was on a corner, with a swinging screen door giving onto each street. As I pushed open the screen door, something happened to me. The best way of describing it is to say that the connection between me and my body was instantaneously severed. The soda fountain was there in front of me, but I could not go to it. Instead, I turned right, walked to the other door, and went out into the street. But then I had to turn right again, go around the corner and back to the first door. I repeated the operation and saw Mrs. Roth look up at me with surprise as I went out for the second time. I was caught in something that I could not break out of, and I tried desperately not to go into the shop a third time. However, I did go in and marched straight through and out the other door.
Luckily, his parents happened to go by in a car just then, and he jumped in. Otherwise, he felt he would have had to spend the rest of his life circling a soda fountain. As he grew up, Bowles began to circle a career as a composer of serious music, that is. This is one of his piano preludes. Not bad, I think. Not terribly original, either. Turned out the music worked best in the background, as incidental music for theater. Bowles collaborated with big names like Orson Welles, Tennessee Williams, Merce Cunningham. But then, in 1938, he married the writer Jane Auer, Jane Bowles, and she published a novel, and he thought, well, he might write one, too. And he lit out for North Africa and began to travel around the desert, more or less aimlessly. While traveling, he wrote his first and most famous novel, The Sheltering Sky. The two main characters are a man and a woman, Americans, wandering through the North African desert more or less aimlessly. They're married, or at least highly dependent on each other, but something's wrong. Everything's wrong. Both of them are on the edge of falling apart, collapsing, disintegrating. No reason, that's just how it is. And then they do collapse. He dies of typhoid in the middle of nowhere. With him gone, she has absolutely no idea who she is. She stumbles out into the desert, gets picked up by some nomads, and winds up in a harem. You could say they're both swallowed by the desert, by the sky, by nothingness.
He opened his eyes, shut his eyes, saw only the thin sky stretched across to protect him.
Bull's hero dying.
Slowly the split would occur, the sky draw back, and he would see what he never doubted lay behind advance upon him with the speed of a million winds. His cry was a separate thing beside him in the desert. It went on and on. His cry went out through the final image, the spots of raw, bright blood on the earth, blood on excrement. The supreme moment high above the desert when two elements, blood and excrement, long kept apart, merge. A black star appears, a point of darkness in the night sky's clarity, point of darkness and gateway to repose. Reach out. Pierce the fine fabric of the sheltering sky. Take repose.
Bol settled in Morocco in Tangier, a city some people found chaotic and dangerous. For him, that was part of the charm, that and the fact that he never did get used to it. It remained his strange place, the dream city.
If I said that Tangier struck me as a dream city, I should mean it in the strict sense. Its topography was rich in prototypical dream scenes, covered arches like corridors with doors opening into rooms on each side, hidden terraces high above the sea, streets consisting only of steps, dark impasses, small squares built on sloping terrain so that they looked like ballet sets designed in false perspective, as well as the classical dream equipment of tunnels, ramparts, ruins, dungeons, and cliffs.
And if the people of Tangier were fond of magic and poisons, well, so much the better.
I relish the idea that in the night, all around me in my sleep, sorcery is burrowing its invisible tunnels in every direction, from thousands of senders to thousands of unsuspecting recipients. Spells are being cast. Poison is running its course. Souls are being dispossessed.
When Jane Bowles had a stroke in 1957, they both thought she'd been poisoned. She never recovered, never wrote again. But he went right on, composing, turning out novels, short stories, recording Moroccan folk music, and becoming more and more famous. His apartment in Tangier became a kind of pilgrimage site for writers. William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, Truman Capote, Gore Vidal, they all came. Anyone could. Bowles didn't have a phone, but if you turned up at his door, he was happy to talk. Here he is in 1967, chatting with ZBS radio producer Tom Lopez. Bowles is reminiscing about a notorious party thrown by a countess who lived in Tangier.
It was a party given by the Comtesse de la Faye. She had a huge estate outside Tangier, and she got an entire Berber village to come for the evening with the babies and hobbies outside in the gardens. And there they all were in their little shacks and so on with fires. She just brought the country into her estate and rebuilt it, you see. And then the party took place among the shacks and so on. people dancing, eating fire, breathing smoke out of their mouths. Sheer chaos and pandemonium. Everyone in costume. Fantastic costumes which Cecil Beaton designed. He, of course, was there. Marvelous costumes there were. And Truman Capote came as the Spirit of Spring. He looked like a healthy baby.
Yes.
Yes. Painted to look like a rosebud, I suppose. I don't know. It was all very strange. He said,
I'm the Spirit of Spring.
The party degenerated into a real scandal eventually. There was a woman there, the wife of the American military advisor, who was extremely drunk. In fact, she was always drunk. She got into the middle of the floor and got hold of a viper that the man, the snake charmer, had wound around him and began pulling it. And it began strangling the man, you see, and she wouldn't let go of it. And he was beating, flailing with his arms, trying to get her to let go of his snake, and she wouldn't let go of it. And she was saying, I want it! I want it! My snake! I want it! But it was a turning point of the party, because it really degenerated from that moment on, and there were terrible fights and blood and people rushing around, and the servants then, the Moroccans turned against the Europeans. Servants of the house all rushed out and let the punctured the tires of the cars outside, so that when people wanted to go home, of course they couldn't go. Ah, it's lovely.
You're listening to Strange Days on Hearing Voices. This is a Jalala ceremony, Bowles taped in 1965. The recording is rough, but it's a miracle he was able to do it at all. This is not folk music for tourists. It's meant to propel the Jalali, the dancers, into a trance at the height of which, quote, special acts are done. I'm quoting from the liner notes of the CD. Special acts include slashing arms with knives, whipping backs with belts, eating live animals, handling hot coals, and let's see, drinking buckets of boiling water, that sort of thing. Kind of Bowles' cup of tea.
A stork was passing over desert country on his way north. He was thirsty, and he began to look for water.
A short story Bowles wrote in 62.
When he came to the mountains of Kang Elgar, he saw a pool at the bottom of a ravine. He flew down between the rocks and lighted at the edge of the water. Then he walked in and drank. At that moment, a hyena limped up.
Now, the stork has never seen a hyena before, but he's heard the old story that if a hyena urinates on you, even a little bit, even a drop, then he has you in his power forever. So the stork heads to the middle of the pond. The hyena keeps limping around and around, and the stork keeps edging away.
I know what is in your head, said the hyena. You believe the story about me. You believe I have that power? Perhaps long ago hyenas were like that, but now they are the same as everyone else.
Well, says the stork, maybe so, but why do people tell that story? Why do people always hate hyenas and try to kill them?
The hyena squinted. You are lucky, he told the stork. Men never try to kill you because they think you are holy. They call you a saint and a sage. And yet, if you really understood, you would know that magic is a grain of dust in the wind and that Allah has power over everything. You would not be afraid.
Then they get into a long theological discussion. Does magic really exist? Would Allah allow it?
Finally, the stork said, you mean that if there is no magic, the one who sins is the one who believes there is? The hyena laughed. I said nothing about sin, but you did, and you are the sage. I am not in the world to tell anyone what is right or wrong. Living from night to night is enough. Everyone hopes to see me dead.
The stork thinks this is all very interesting. It's getting dark, though. Time to move on. He starts to fly off, but he spent so much time talking with the hyena, it really is dark now, and he flies smack into a cliff and breaks his wing. The hyena comes limping up and says, "You better come back to my cave and spend the night with me." The stork is none too happy about that, but what else can he do? They go to the hyena's cave.
There was only darkness inside. The stork stood still. "Where are you?" he said. "I am here," the hyena answered, and he laughed. "Why are you laughing?" asked the stork. "I was thinking that the world is strange," the hyena told him. "The saint has come into my cave because he believed in magic." "I don't understand," said the stork. "You are confused, but at least now you can believe that I have no magic. I am like anyone else in the world." The stork did not answer right away. He smelled the stench of the hyena very near him. Then he said with a sigh, "You are right, of course. There is no power beyond the power of Allah." "I am happy," said the hyena, breathing into his face. "At last you understand." Quickly, he seized the stork's neck and tore it open. "Allah gave me something better than magic," the hyena said. "He gave me a brain."
The stork is dead now, but because the hyena prefers carrion, he goes away for 10 days, then comes back to feast on the rotten meat.
He devoured what he wanted and went outside to a large flat rock above the entrance to the cave. There in the moonlight he stood a while, vomiting. He ate some of his vomit and rolled for a long time in the rest of it, rubbing it deep into his coat. Then he thanked Allah for eyes that could see the valley in the moonlight and for a nose that could smell carrion on the wind. He rolled some more and licked the rock under him. For a while he lay there, panting. Soon he got up and limped on his way.
The story's unusual for bulls on account of the talking animals, but otherwise it's got his usual suspicion that at the heart of life, behind the sheltering palms, above the sheltering sky, lies a thing we don't like to know about, something like horror. In The Sheltering Sky, Bowles quoted a line from the French poet Valéry in his autobiography called Without Stopping. At the very end, the very last paragraph, he comes back to that line.
"Goodbye," says the dying man to the mirror they hold in front of him. "We won't be seeing each other anymore." When I quoted Valéry's epigram in The Sheltering Sky, it seemed a poignant bit of fantasy. Now, because I no longer imagine myself as an onlooker at the scene, but instead the principal protagonist, it strikes me as repugnant. To make it right, the dying man would have to add 2 words to his little farewell, and they are, "Thank God."
"Down, way down among the sheltering palms, oh honey, wait for me, oh honey, wait for me. Meet me down by the old golden gate, out where the sun goes down about 8. Oh, how my love is burning, burning, burning. How my heart is yearning, yearning, yearning to be down among the sheltering palms, oh honey, wait for me."
Paul Bowles died in 1999. His writing was read by Paul Kernan, The Hyena, the short story, by Erica Heilman. Down Among the Sheltering Palms was performed by Bing Crosby, Earl Hines, and the New Sensations. That 1967 conversation is from the ZBS tape, A Time in Tangier.
Here I am. When I am here, I shall not mind. I shall merely murmur. If no one comes and sees me here, it will be all right. Here it is hard to believe that anything is free. Come, let us lapse into freedom. Let all these things become less than dust. Let me not think at all, ever. Let these things come closer together. Let everything be slow and soft. Let the wind blow over the roof at noon. Let the great city lie slow under the sun at noon. Let everything be soft here because there is no dust. Let anything except what is coming come. That is the way I have always felt.
Recording by Paul Bowles from his album Black Star at the Point of Darkness.
Down among the sheltering palms, oh honey, wait for me. Honey, won't you be there? Down neath the palms, I'll be there. Honey, wait for me, oh you darling. Down among the sheltering.
Hearing Voices will be back in just a minute with some rather more upbeat ways of making strange days.
Is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Strange Days on Hearing Voices. Imagine you're in San Francisco in the early 1960s. You're walking down the street, minding your own business, when these guys come up. They have a microphone and a little tape recorder. They mumble something about a radio station. And then this happens.
Excuse me, Sandor 21.
Beg your pardon?
Repeat, Sandor 21.
Sandor 21.
All right, you said Sandor 21, right? Mm-hmm. Sandor 22, repeat.
Sandor 22.
Now, how about an inclusion of both of those in one sentence? We'll explain why.
Make a sentence out of both?
Yes, and we'll explain why.
Well, I don't know what it is to start with.
Sandor 21 and Sandor 22 could be used.
Sandor 21, Sandor 22 could be used.
All right, you have attained the seventh stage. Now, if you would try and concentrate just for a moment on your first statement, Sandor 21. You perhaps will enter into the eighth stage. Now, would you concentrate on that and repeat it to yourself, or repeat it in a hushed voice three times? Go ahead.
We're trying to do it.
I repeat this again?
Yeah. Yes. And concentrate. You're at stage eight.
Do I say this?
Yeah.
No. Say stage eight, and then repeat in a hushed voice a sentence.
Stage eight. Sandor 21, and Sandor 21 could be used.
All right. Now, what we're going to do... Not in a way that is evident to you. We're going to filter that sentence. In other words, we're going
to get back to work.
Excuse me?
I have to get back to work.
Before the filtration?
Beg your pardon?
Before the filtration?
Before the filtration?
Yeah, we're going to filtrate it right now.
Do you understand what we're doing?
No.
We're going to take the sentence that you uttered, which was a combination of the 21 and the 22 thoughts, right? You made a composite out of them. It was your composite, right? We're going to filter that composite sentence. Then we're just going to give it back to you, and we don't care how what you you know, what you do with that. Can we filter the sentence?
Certainly.
All right. Will you repeat once more, Sandor 21 and Sandor 22 can be used. We'll filter.
Sandor 21.
Go ahead.
And Sandor 22 can be used.
All right. Now, that sentence is filtered, and it's yours. That's it.
Okay.
I don't really understand what was going on.
We took a sentence that you uttered that was a Sandoristic sentence, combining two separate Sandoristic numeral sets. You then took the two separate Sandoristic numerical sets and made a composite sentence. You projected a composite...
And what does this prove?
We took it and we filtered it, and then we returned it to you. That's the basis of it.
Oh, now I'm stuck with it.
No, you know what stage you're at, don't you?
Now I'm at stage 8 now.
Right.
Yeah. You've given me a sentence.
What kind of a sentence?
It really doesn't make sense to me.
What we're trying to do is give people something that they didn't have. We've given you, rather than a watch or rather than money or something like that, we've given you a filtered, composite, Sandoristic sentence. That's it.
Fine.
Okay.
I have to go.
All right.
And there's no charge. Thank you very much.
Well, that was Mal Sharp and his partner Jim Coyle doing one of their man-on-the-street interviews. What were they up to? Here's another one.
We've just stopped a gentleman. A young man is in the Navy. Could we have your name, please?
Lewis.
Lewis, I'd like you to meet James P. Coyle.
Glad to meet you.
Glad to meet you. Well, now, Lewis, Mr. Coyle is going to tell you very briefly about a film he's working on here in the city, and after he finishes, if you want to discuss any aspect of it,
I really would.
Mr. Coyle, would you tell Lewis about the film?
Very good. The name of the film is Daring But Dead. The idea is very simply... It centers around a bank robbery, which takes place in a city. We hope to approach it in a unique way, and we're actually going to film it in a bank. Do you understand the nature of it?
I come from Philadelphia. I'd like to know it. I really would.
Right. Everybody in the bank will be actors, but we're going to try and get the main role, in other words, the protagonist of this film. We're going to use a person without dramatic background. Would you yourself be interested in... giving a crack at that role? There's no money involved, but there's a possibility for fame.
Yes, I really would. I mean, I think it'd be a good film. I really do. I honestly do.
The idea is you are to go in the bank, ask for $11,000. You can use some type of a weapon or not. And we are actually, I've chosen Mr. Sharp from the radio station, and myself are playing two of the other roles in the film. We'll be sitting out in a car outside the bank. Would you be willing to give it a try?
I would be, because I'm a gunner's mate in the Navy, and I know I could do it. I mean, I just walk in, I'd hold it up.
Yeah.
Because, the man that's never committed a crime before is the one that can do it.
Right,
that's
exactly.
True. I could do it. I mean, I can get hold of a machine gun. I can get hold of any kind of weapon you want.
Would you be willing? We're doing some filming this afternoon. Would you be willing to try it?
Yes, I would.
Fine, we'll go up to a bank here. Would you be able to get a hold of a weapon this afternoon?
Yeah, I would.
You won't see the cameras. We'll just go in and it'll look like a regular bank robbery. No cameras, nothing.
That's right. I would. I'd go in there.
And you'd come out with the money and meet us in the car.
That's right.
All right, let's go.
Okay, fine.
What's wrong?
That's a good plan. What do you mean, what's wrong?
What, you going to go with us?
Yeah, I'll go with you. What do you mean, go with you?
What are you going to do?
I'd hold up a bank.
Okay, let's go.
Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Come on.
What do you mean, come on?
We're going to do it now.
You've agreed to hold the bank up, right?
What's wrong?
What do you mean, what's wrong? You guys actually want to hold up a bank right now, don't
right.
you? I know you do. You guys got a gun?
No.
You were going to have the gun.
You would be the guy who'd go in the bank.
What kind of guys are you?
We're just out to make a buck, and if we can use a guy that's got no criminal experience.
You really
are,
huh?
Yeah.
You guys are all right. Which bank you not yet?
The bank right down on the corner.
You guys just don't walk in there, huh? With
you
the machine.
You.
Me.
You walk in, we wait outside in the car.
You guys got a good scheme here.
You know, we've discussed it with you pretty openly. You know the score.
Yeah.
We get you to go in the bank, you take the risk, we sit out in the car, we get the money. If you're caught, you know, you don't even know who we are. See, we have no past association with you.
That's right. See, if I get shot by the cop, you guys don't know nothing.
Yeah,
right.
We just drive off.
I'm a stoolie, right?
You're a pigeon.
Yeah.
You're lying on the steps of the bank, riddled with bullets, and we're driving across the bridge.
Let me say one thing.
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
You two guys, with a scheme like that, just stopping a guy on the street with a policeman right next to me.
Yeah.
You could actually pull off a job like that.
Sure
you could. Three men.
Right.
I'm serious.
Sharp and Coyle found they could talk people into all sorts of strange things. They called these performances terrorizations. A better word now might be strangifications, although that may not be a real word.
Do you think that new techniques in the film are making Hollywood films better?
Yes, I do, actually.
Do you feel that a new technique of vocal projection could conceivably meet with an open mind on the part of the public?
Well, with a view to myself, I'm in favor of any new techniques, see how they do, and then judge them after they come out.
Can we give you an example of it now just to get your reaction to it?
If it's quick.
Okay, fine.
We'll be very quick. Here we go. This is a scene. I'm a detective. This gentleman is some type of criminal who has a weapon. You got that gun. Give me the gun. Gun.
You can have the gun. I won't give you the gun.
Give me the gun. Gun. I want that gun. I want that gun. I want that gun. Give it to me. Give it. Now. It's my gun.
No.
Give me. I want that gun. Gun. Give me the gun.
Could you try now with ourselves to speak in this manner, and then we'd like to ask your opinion?
I very much doubt it.
Let me just show you that you can. Simply ask us the time. Simply say, would you give me the time? Just quickly.
The problem with giving you the time is, there's no deep emotions involved.
Do you want to take something more emotional? I mean, would you like to take part in the detective scene again, where you would say, stay away from the gun, stay away from the gun. Would you feel that more intensely?
You could do it under that circumstance. Yeah. Saying the time. I mean, I'm just saying that would have very little real meaning to it there.
All right, let's do it this time. You're an associate of Mr. Coyle here, but you're telling him to stay away from the gun, and I have the gun, right?
Yeah.
Okay, your role is stay away from that gun. Stay away. Don't get near the gun. Okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Give me the gun.
Thank you.
Is that just because it's San Francisco? Anyway, if they don't play along, Sharp and Coyle blithely ignore them.
Can we have your name, please?
Stephen King.
Stephen, I'd like you to meet James P. Coyle.
Glad to meet you, Stephen.
How do you do, sir?
Now, Mr. Coyle is a hypnotist. He's applied for a job at KGO. We're going to be utilizing one of these people at our radio station for various purposes over the air. Before selecting one of them, we audition them on the streets. And Mr. Coyle will now explain what he would like to do with you.
What I would like to do today, very briefly, is deprive you of your power of speech for a short period of time. I would like to deprive you of your oral capacities for 15 to 20 minutes, and I would ask your cooperation. Would you be willing to attempt this?
On the street?
Right now, yes.
I'd be willing to attempt it.
Very fine.
Okay, fine. Are you prepared, Mr. Coyle?
I certainly am. Now, actually, you're facing the street. I would prefer if the gentleman could be facing in toward the sidewalk rather than with the motion of the cars and the public vehicles behind us.
Okay, fine. Can we turn around for just a second?
Right.
Swell.
Try and associate yourself with the task that we have before us, which is simply a matter of you're losing your power of speech. Try to follow what I'm saying and prepare yourself for a loss of oral capacity. Try to face the fact that man doesn't need his voice. Try to accept the fact that speech is a supplemental part of human existence, which is not necessary. Try to remember that in one time in history, man was unable to speak. Now, I am going to, in the next 30 seconds, say one word. And after that one word is uttered, you are going to be unable to speak for 15 minutes. Are you prepared?
I'm prepared.
Now I will utter the one word. Grievance. Speak.
I can still speak.
Now, the gentleman has lost his power of speech. Now, Mr. Coyle, could you tell me...
Give him another chance. Speak.
I can still speak.
Your lips are moving, but you're not speaking.
Yes, Mr. Coyle, would you tell me now, how long do you intend to keep this person under this hypnotic spell?
Insofar as I can control it, I would like to keep it to 15 or 20 minutes.
All right. We'll just keep him here on the edge of the sidewalk, then, for another 10 or 15.
Would I be able, in that interim period, to interview other people?
Okay. We'll try and get some other people. Let's move this fellow back.
Let's give him one more chance. Yeah. Speak.
I can still speak.
Speak. Make a sound come from within yourself.
Could you tell us your name, please?
Stephen King.
Could you tell us...
Let me see whether I can read his lips.
Yeah.
Would you tell us your name?
Stephen King.
Stanley Klang Stanley, would you tell us your name once more?
Stephen King.
Why don't Stanley you King.
Why don't you shout into his ear? I don't think he, you know.
No, he can hear me.
No, his eyes are glassy.
He can hear me.
Yeah.
Is Stanley King your name? Just nod, yes or no, please. What is King your name?
Yes.
He's nodding yes. We will arouse you again with the word grievance spoken sharply in 15 minutes. Are you willing just to rest over on the side here?
I can still speak.
He's nodding. He will. Thank you very much, Stephen.
You're listening to Strange Days on Hearing Voices.
We are from Hanseatic Zoological League. I ask you this question. We have this ourselves, a group of animals that we have brought from our country.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like to have them do things that people can do. You know the game. You know the football. Would you be able to take the animals and train them to play, and make a team of them to play these boys?
Animals?
Yes.
Yeah. What kind of animals?
We have wolverines, which are very fast.
You see, we are keeping them very hungry, so that they remain vicious in the game.
How big are the wolverines?
They are as big as, a Great Dane.
But the wolverines we have all weigh over 300 pounds.
How do they throw passes? How do they center the ball like that kid's doing right now? How do they get through their four legs and throw it back to the dog behind us?
Wolverines against humans in football. This is what we wish. Now, what would be bad? You say before, trouble with centering the football.
Well, they got a center between the legs, right?
Who does?
The center.
Yes.
That'd be the wolverine. Right?
We know this, that something like this takes time. You don't overnight take animals. You don't take beasts and make them athletes. If you could train them so well, we have then a game for they play these boys here.
Mm-hmm. Well, wolverine will tear them apart. You say they were vicious. You keep them hungry.
Yeah.
All right. And then they have to either tackle the player or touch the player.
Who tackles?
Who would
the wolverine would have to grab him, or either with their paws or with their jaws.
Would you suggest?
Especially if the guy had the ball and the wolverine trying to get him, he'd probably take a hunk out of his fanny, but he'd catch him.
What would be the first fundamentals you would teach the wolverine?
You have to teach him how to stand still and line up.
Yeah.
That's the first thing.
Yeah. Then what?
Then that's it. They can get that far, then I'll teach him the rest.
You'll find lots more Sharp and Coyle on a CD-DVD set called These Two Men Are Imposters. They're also very hardworking, which raises the question, isn't there an easier way to get strange? Well, of course there is. It's called a psychedelic drug. I'm betting you could find a mind-altering substance within a stone's throw of your house, depending on where you live. It's pretty easy. Or, like our friend John Rieger, you could do it the hard way.
Suppose you woke up one day and realized you're sad. You're about 50. Your career is okay and pointless. You've got a nice home and a family you love, and all you seem to do is pick on them. At a dark time in his own life, right after he shot his wife, William Burroughs made a fevered trip to the Amazon to explore the sacred spiritual medicine called Yahe, or ayahuasca, the vine of the dead. That would not have been my first choice. But a friend was researching a scholarly book and needed to make the trip, and we decided to go together. Hey, at least it would be a vacation.
Ayahuasca, the dead vine.
Iquitos, Peru. 500,000 people on the upper Amazon, inaccessible by road, and eager for tourists.
My name is Juan Maldonado. I'm a jungle guide. If you give it to me, your internet, I give it to you, the jungle survivor course. And if you want to know about shamanismo, I can talk to you about from my trips. And I talk to the really shaman.
Iquitos might be the Jerusalem of ayahuasca. In this jungle, for thousands of years, the native shamans, or curanderos, have used ayahuasca to cure disease and work magic. Today, the three-wheeled taxis that jam these streets are driven by people who talk to spirits. Our teenage greeter at the airport tells us of becoming a giant snake and having a tearful reunion with his dead grandmother. Ayahuasca is believed to cure asthma, depression, and alcoholism. It's revered as a pathway to a spiritual life. And word is spreading. Ecotourists and adventure tourists are becoming ayahuasca tourists. More than a third of recent visitors to the Iquitos tourist office asked for the vine of the dead.
One kilogram of ayahuasca vine, 50 chacruna leaves, 5 gallons of water.
On the muddy banks of the Yanuyaku River, about 3 hours boat ride from Iquitos, stands the Loving Light Lodge, a comfy outpost with plank floors, thatched roofs, and mosquito nets. A few days here is like a trip to family camp, with jungle treks, piranha fishing, swimming with the pink river dolphins, not conducted in the same location, and ayahuasca ceremonies.
I'm going to sing.
Adonai, Ado for short, is our guide. He's a knowledgeable botanist and an apprentice shaman.
Mana mana warami, mana mana warami.
This song, called Enikaro, is a love charm, which calls on the spirit of the strangle fig. The jungle contains dozens of medicinal plants, each with its own magical spirit, and a shaman's apprenticeship is spent learning from these spirits. Two plants are essential to the ayahuasca brew. A leafy plant called chacruna, which contains the powerful psychedelic DMT, similar to the brain chemical serotonin, and the ayahuasca vine, which has a chemical that allows DMT to be digested. Neither would be effective without the other, and the ancestral shaman who first combined them achieved a feat of pharmacology that still baffles anthropologists. The vine is crushed and boiled with the leaves for several hours until they form a viscous fluid with the color of a latte and a nasty reputation. How does it taste?
Oh, just doesn't have any taste. You know, it's a little...
You're a liar. You are a liar.
New people coming to drink the ayahuasca, they feel like it's horrible, you know? But for people who used to drink the ayahuasca all the time, tastes different and a little sweet.
Tonight will be our first ceremony. Our curandera is Norma Panduro, a compact and dignified woman in her 50s who produces a disreputable-looking plastic bottle, half-filled with tan glop.
Is this the ayahuasca?
This is the ayahuasca. It was brewed by the hands of her own granddaughter. Jauri, age 13, has drunk ayahuasca 3 times. She is Norma's apprentice.
Su nieta va a ser curandera?
Exacto. Es su vocación que ella quiere.
Sí, me gusta. Y me gustaría aprender muchas cosas más.
The ceremony is a disarmingly informal affair. We sit or lounge on thin foam pads in the dark lodge. As the jungle twilight fades, Norma takes a big puff of the fragrant local tobacco called mapacho. Tobacco smoke is used abundantly to protect the ceremonial space and beckon the spirits. Marlboros are apparently also acceptable. We each have a small plastic bucket. Vomiting is intrinsic to the healing power of the medicine, which is often called la purga, the purge.
Don't try to stop the vomit. Just let it go. After you're through, you're going to feel so light your body. And then the visions will come. You can see all over the world, whatever you want. You are in your mind, you must have to ask what you want to see. And then it's going to transport to that place. Okay?
Okay. We each drink about 3 fingers of the stuff, then sit quietly. Norma begins to sing. After about 20 minutes, my friend starts to vomit profusely. Suddenly, although it must be 80 degrees, I'm shivering uncontrollably. Exhausted from travel and far from home, I'm overcome with longing for my family, and I start to weep. I ask the ayahuasca to take me to them, to show me my sons in their beds, and let me touch their hair. But I'm stuck in the darkness, in the jungle, shaking and nauseated. And I start to wonder, what if it never stops? What if I have to go home like this? My wife will kill me. The morning after our ceremony, Norma is sitting by an open fire, methodically pounding chunks of vine with a big stick and adding them to a steaming aluminum cauldron. I've spent an exhausting night, sleepless in my cot, the bucket close at hand. I really don't want to be poisoned again. But Norma is adamant.
Te sientes cobarde. Dices, ya no voy a tomar más. No, 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 no.
When you're cowardly, she says, the medicine tests you. One must be valiant.
Valiente. Por eso cualquiera no es ayahuasquero ni ayahuasquera.
And I have another problem. I'm here on assignment, and I don't have a story. The spirits never appeared. And when I asked the ayahuasca to take away my sadness, there was no reply.
John tiene un brillante éxito en su carrera profesional, pero le falta estar más cerca de Dios.
Just she say, you are brilliant in the job you are doing, but you need to be also a little bit close to God, close to God.
Voy a ayudar a John. Te voy a ayudar, John.
Norma says she's going to help me. That night, the sky is unsettled. As we drink, the horizon is flickering with distant lightning. As the nausea steals over me again, Norma commands me to pray in whatever way I know. Only, I don't know. I don't pray. But if I'm serious about the ceremony, how can I refuse? So, I pray to whomever. I pray for the sadness in my life to be taken away. I want to see visions. I want to purge the sadness, to step into the light and know the meaning of my life. And a thought comes to me from, well, I guess from me. If you want to see the light, you have to agree to serve God, however he may require. But suppose he wants me to become a missionary and convert the heathens. I won't do that. If you can't make that promise, then there will be no light. Well, could I just get a hint of what God has in mind so I'll know if I can afford to sign up? And then I see this big question mark. That's your question mark, pal. What is the purpose of your life? That's what you're asking for. You can't reason with revelation. You have to accept what's revealed. And then, all of a sudden, I have a vision. A spirit appears. And it's a television.
It's new.
It's the latest.
Design.
Fashion.
A photo shoot.
A cover story.
It's done.
It's a hit.
Boring.
Change the channel.
It won't go away. And I can't turn it off because each TV is just a picture on an even bigger TV.
What's on?
It's a hit.
Latest.
It's new.
Design.
It's a hit.
Boring.
Change the channel.
So, like, this is supposed to be my job?
In short, it was a complete vacation. A whirlwind trip to the Peruvian Amazon, 2 nights of convulsive therapy, and a religious experience in the jungle. In my youthful experiments with psychedelics, every journey left me wanting to return to that beautiful place. But that was 30 years ago. I'm older and stiffer now. Ayahuasca is hard work. Maybe I'm just fine the way I am. And yet, I'm curious. What's behind that question mark?
Ayahuasca Tourism was produced by John Rieger for Savvy Traveler. This is Hearing Voices. I'm Larry Massett. The website is hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.